two transferring Rotarians that we would like to welcome into our club. So at this time, if we could have Dean Weidler and Reed Dunn come up, please. Go over here.
As the chairman of the membership committee, I get the honors to introduce these transferring Rotarians. And this is going to be a short snapshot of who they are. Dennis is retired, sort of. And is moved back into the house that they've owned for 14 years in Homer. And he's coming to us from Nome. And he's in, just so you're aware of this, he's in production.
Media production.
And there are a couple of things that I'll put out here that he has been the voice of both Ronald McDonald and the Hamburglar. So this gives you, well, it's always good to have a celebrity in town. That's right. And he has been the, he joined Rotary in October of 99. He has been the president of the Rotary Club up in Nome. And I asked him when he was the, said he was a secretary for life, but he finished that term, and I was looking that he was standing up, and I said, that was pretty good.
Still here.
But we are very glad to have Dennis with us. Reed is another retiree. This seems to be a good place to come back to. Of course, this was, I know how this one is because his daughter has lived here with her family for, 12 years? I hope she doesn't move away. I speak from experience.
Right.
But he's coming to us from Wasilla, the Sunrise Club in Wasilla, and we are very glad that he decided way back when to leave Detroit and come to Alaska. So, welcome to both. And what we have for both of you is, you can get rid of those fake badges now. No more singing. And we have a couple of cars for both of you.
Thank you.
Go. And what we'll do is, before you leave today, please take the time to come up and welcome Dennis and Reed, because we're compressing our time band here, because I know someone's going to get a lot of questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Yes, typically everybody gets up and comes around for a handshake, but we're not going to do that today. But please take an opportunity to introduce yourselves to them, and maybe next week we will do that. So I'd like to go ahead now and introduce our guest of honor, Senator Lisa Murkowski. And I wanted to just preface, I think it's really great to have her here speaking to our Rotary Club. We are celebrating in Rotary 30 years of women in Rotary, and so and Lisa represents I looked up the stats, 21% of the total number of women in Congress. So, you know, they have a long way to go too to get women represented in Congress. So, and Rotary has been working really hard to increase women presence in Rotary as well. So it's great to have her here. I'm going just to read your bio that was sent to me to give you an introduction to that. And I wanted to also just say thank you, Lisa, for coming to Homer to visit us. Thank you for visiting Center for Coastal Studies this morning. Thank you for going to the City Hall. And we really appreciate you coming here to talk. And obviously there's a lot of people interested to hear what you have to say, so we appreciate you taking the time to be down here. Senator Lisa Murkowski, she's the first Alaskan-born senator and only the sixth United States senator to serve the state. The state senior senator, Lisa Murkowski, is a third-generation Alaskan, born in Ketchikan and raised in towns across the state. She's lived in Wrangell, Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage, and since joining the Senate in 2002, she's been a strong advocate for Alaska on the important issues facing the state, including energy, healthcare, education, military, veterans affairs, and infrastructure development. Only the 32nd female to serve in the United States Senate since its founding in 1789, Senator Murkowski has assumed leadership roles very quickly. She's the chairman of the State Energy and Natural Resources Committee and also serves on the State Appropriations Committee, where she's the chairman of the Interior and Environment Subcommittee. Senator Murkowski is a member of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, the first Alaskan to serve on that panel, and is also a senior member of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. Very busy. She earned a BA in economics from Georgetown University in 1980 and a law degree from Willamette University in 1985. Prior to her appointment to the United States Senate, Senator Murkowski practiced commercial law in Anchorage and was elected to three terms in the Alaska State House of Representatives. She was elected to a full six-year U.S. Senate term in 2004 and was re-elected in 2010 in the historic write-in campaign, the first successful write-in effort to the Senate since 1954. I do remember that one. On a personal note, she's married to Vern Martell, and they have two sons, and she enjoys spending time with her family in the Alaskan outdoors. So with that, I'd like to welcome you, Senator Murkowski, and have you come on up and...
So Beth tells me that this is your inaugural meeting as president, and so recognizing women in Rotary, congratulations to you. So thanks for the opportunity to be back in Homer. Thank you for just a spectacular morning. I was a little late getting started. I was actually over, as Beth mentioned, at the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies, and I was a little bit tardy because I couldn't pull myself away from the view of the water this morning. I'm just reminded of the enormous blessing that we have in living in some pretty extraordinary places around the state. And you all live it every day. So thank you for sharing it with me. Before I begin my comments, I want to make sure that I give introductions to some of the folks that are working with me to make sure that your needs are met. Michelle Blackwell is my representative down here on the Kenai. She's basing out of Soldotna, but I know that you see her a lot down here, but she is your local contact. Next to her is her son, Jackson Blackwell. And Jackson, I'm just saying right here, right now, I got my money on him for United States Senate in what, 2030? Is that about right? This young man is going places. He was just back in Washington, D.C. as one of my interns over this past month. And boy, if you don't think we're producing some great young men and women out of our Alaskan schools, Jackson's a perfect example of that. Another local product here, Karina Peterson from Soldotna, has been back in Washington, D.C., running my communications effort and is doing a great job for me and for Alaska, so I appreciate the fact that she's here as well. So I am here today to give you a legislative update. And some would say, well, that's going to be really easy because they haven't done a darn thing. I want to dispel a little bit of that because, in fact, sometimes things that are happening don't get reported because they're positive, they're constructive. We're actually making some things happen. And you will note that the federal government is still open, and I believe the state government is as well. I need to recognize the good work of your state representative, Representative Seaton, but making sure that again, we were able to pass that budget through earlier this year was important. We are underway with our appropriations bills right now. As Beth mentioned in my bio there, I'm the chairman of the I'm on the Appropriations Committee, and I'm chairman of the Interior Appropriations. That's a pretty significant appropriations subcommittee for us. It is not only the Department of Interior and all of our public lands. It's also the EPA. So as it relates to our waters, as it relates to our environment, so we are in process right now, working on a legislative agenda that I hope will be more reflective of the needs not only of us here in Alaska, but around the country. The White House issued its proposal, budget proposal, in, it was like the second week in May. It was met with less than enthusiasm, I think it's fair to say. But as one secretary mentioned, he says, you know, and folks, this is kind of what a tough balanced budget looks like. It is really tough, and quite honestly, we as the lawmakers and as the appropriators look at that and say, okay, it's nice to know where your priorities are here, but this is your budget proposal. What we do as the appropriators is we now determine where these spending priorities are going to be. So we had an opportunity this morning as we were over at the Coastal Waterways Group, you know, talking about things like the NOAA budget and the significance of that to our coastal communities, whether you're here in Homer or whether you're down in Wrangell where I was over the 4th of July. The recognition there that so much of what comes with just good, solid research and data helps us in so many different ways. And it's important that I hear from you right now as we are laying down these appropriations bills and as we move into these committee markups. Judge, you introduced me. Who'd you just introduce me to? From
Jessica.
Was it Jessica? Yes. And I said, help me out with those specific grant programs that we really see that value to. Because right now, the proposal coming out of the White House is pretty skinny and very negative on many of the priorities that we as Alaskans would like to see. So know that whether it's programs like Essential Air Service that allow for lower costs for our very remote rural communities, or whether it's grant funding for some of our programs that allow for a level of science that enhance our fisheries, that allow for our fishing families to sustain themselves. These are the types of things that I need now and I need early. And so I appreciate that quick feedback as we move through the appropriations process. Good news that doesn't get reported. Bipartisanship. Everyone's looking at me like, I thought you got rid of that. That's nervous laughter. It is important to recognize that there are good men and women trying to do a good job, not only for their respective constituencies, but for the country. Senator Cantwell and I have been a team on the Energy Committee now for the past 4 years. She's from Washington State. She has very different views on, for instance, ANWR than I have. And we come at issues a little bit differently, but we determined some years ago that rather than focusing on those areas of separation, of distance between us, that the best thing that we could be doing to help with our country and how we are a more resilient nation when it comes to our energy sources is to figure out those areas that we have common ground. So a couple years ago, we worked for 2 years to build a bipartisan energy bill. We were told from the get-go, it's not gonna happen, ladies. We're just too separated on too many of these issues. And we decided, nope, we're gonna do it the old-fashioned way. We are gonna slog through committees. We're gonna make it happen. We moved it out of our committees. We got it to the Senate floor. They said, well, that's where it's gonna die an ugly death. It passed out of the Senate 85 to 12. And we caught people by surprise because what we had done is we had worked through a process that was so open and so transparent that by the end of the day, we had ownership from 80 members of the Senate who had a bill in there, an amendment in there that was really significant to them. And it was a successful process. We got snarled up in conference, and Representative Seaton knows what that all means. And unfortunately, at the end of the day, which was the end of last Congress, we weren't able to get it over the finish line. The House basically left, and there was no one to negotiate with in truly the final hour. Well, many people said, okay, nice try, but whatever, we'll get around to energy reform sometime. We haven't updated our energy policies in a full decade now. So we're saying sometime is now. So we said, all right, it's a new year, new Congress, we're gonna re-up it, we're gonna repackage this. We've already had the committee process, we've already pre-conferenced everything, we're gonna move it. We introduced this pretty significant bipartisan legislation. It is on track within the Senate calendar to be taken up again for consideration. So I know that the view of Congress is pretty dim right now, and that is being mild with my words. But I do think it's important that you know that in the midst of all the turmoil that's going on right now, that there is goodwill and good effort to try to legislate. Because as we get all twisted and snarled with healthcare, as we all know that we are, to think that everything else is put on hold is not good. We still have to find those areas where we're working to bring about positive change. So I wanted to make sure that I spoke to that before I moved to the snarl that everyone's been talking about. We had an opportunity just before coming here to have a town hall over at City Chambers. We appreciate the mayor kind of keeping everything in line and order there. But you know, we had good engagement from the community as well as from some folks who came down from Anchorage to participate and hear as well. The update that I would like to share with you, and some of you, you're going to be able to fill in the blanks as you will as well, because you were there. The measure that moved out of the House, the AHCA, in my view, is not a measure that works for Alaskans. It in my view, sets us back. So it is important to me to know that the Senate is not going to be viewing that as a template, because I think just fundamentally there are so many parts of that measure that simply, again, don't work for Alaska. The process that you've seen unfold in the Senate, and perhaps the problem with it is that you haven't seen it unfold in the Senate. It didn't go through committee. It was a measure that was brought together by the Republican leadership. In fairness, there have been many, many meetings. Don't believe that there are not meetings that have not been going on. But the problem is that they haven't been the public process where you know what's going on, where I have an opportunity to weigh in and say, wait a minute, that just doesn't make sense in my state, or doesn't make sense in a rural state. And so right off the bat, in my view, we've got an issue, because when there is not an openness to a process, people get suspicious. What's going on? Why don't we know? And then when it comes out to be told that, well, we're going to turn this around and we're going to have a vote on it within a matter of days. Again, on legislation or a proposal that impacts, basically, when we talk about healthcare, it impacts about 1/6 of our nation's economy. This is pretty serious stuff. And it is important that we get it right. And I think, and not to suggest motives of others, but I think for some, they just want to get healthcare behind us. Getting healthcare behind us doesn't do anybody any good unless we have made healthcare more accessible and more affordable for us. And so to say We've just gotten the votes to pass something so we can move on to something else. How am I supposed to respond to those constituents who say, well, I have health care, but I can't afford it. I can't afford to access it because of the premiums, the deductibles, the out-of-pockets. It's out of sight for me. How am I supposed to respond when people say, well, you didn't do a thing to fix what has gone on in Alaska in terms of our rising costs, of our limited access? So putting it behind us should not be the priority. Getting it right should be our priority. And that's just simply going to take time. And in my view, it's going to take a process that is open and a process that is bipartisan. Because a lot of the complaints that you will hear from Republicans about the Affordable Care Act is that, well, that was a product that the Democrats built. So what are we going to do? We're going to give you a product that the Republicans have built? Well, then the Democrats are just going to shoot at that for the next 10 years. And in the meantime, real families are saying, I'm still struggling. I cannot say that I have coverage. I can't afford my health care. So it is imperative, in my view, that we take the time to get this right. We have fundamentally a divide in this country right now when it comes to how we deal, and maybe I shouldn't use the word deal, how we reform Medicaid so that it is on a more stable trajectory. About half the states opted under the ACA to expand Medicaid. Alaska is one of them. We expanded in 2015. And through that expansion, some 33,000 Alaskans now have a level of coverage that they never had before. So whether it's helping those who need to access mental health issues, whether it's those who are dealing with substance or opioid issues and who haven't been able to gain that level of care, we have seen that benefit. So you have those states that have opted to expand that have seen some real differences in their state. And so it's not necessarily lines that are drawn between Republicans and Democrats, it's expansion states versus non-expansion states. And so there's some real fundamental issues that we have not been able to reconcile. We simply have not been able to reconcile. So you've got that discussion going on there with Medicaid, which is very complicated. When you're talking about trying to put a program on a sustainable path for the future, you can't do this with just one party. You can't do this in a closed process. It needs to have that level of engagement that's going to take some time. So I have suggested, let's separate this. Let's put off to the side right now Medicaid reform. Let's talk about the urgent situation that we're seeing around the country, and that's in the individual market. In Alaska, 18,000 Alaskans are on the individual market. That's not many. But let me tell you, those people who are on the market, who are feeling the impact when you only have one provider that you can go to, who are feeling the impact of the continued premium increases and nothing but higher deductible for them, or those who are on plans through employers that are also seeing those high costs. So can we figure out how we, as lawmakers, Republican and Democrat lawmakers around the country, can come together and address that immediate issue, which is directly within our individual market? I can't tell you, standing here today on a Friday, whether or not next week we will have an opportunity to say, okay, that's the direction that we're going down. I can't tell you that because we have not had that open process where, again, we are creating that measure jointly. So we're going to go back in on Monday and have an opportunity, hopefully, as a Senate, not as Republicans in the Senate, but as a Senate, to begin a broader and more open debate about how we deal with our healthcare issues. I've got to keep an eye on the time because Beth is going to give me the hook, and I've got about 15 minutes or so to answer questions, and I've talked way longer than I thought I was going to, but hopefully that preempted a few of the questions that you have. But happy to turn it over to you now for your comments, questions, and suggestions. So who's going to lead us off?
Senator, I appreciate your comments about the individual market and the 18,000 people in Alaska that are on that, but that's only 10% of the people that are on Medicaid in the state. Okay. Spent over $500 million just on Medicaid folks just since the expansion. How are we going to get the spending under control and get Medicaid on a sustainable path? Because that is not sustainable the way we're headed now.
You're absolutely correct, and I don't think that there is anybody that would disagree that we are not on a sustainable path. But in order to get on that sustainable path, again, I want to make sure that we're doing this in a way that is really well thought out for Alaska as well as for the rest of the country. Because you think about just the statistics the numbers that you have laid down there in terms of what Alaska has seen in terms of the cost. And you've got a representative over here who knows that if there is a, if expansion is pulled back, what that's going to mean to the state in 2018 is about $77 million that he's going to have to find. And that's just in 2018. So when you think about how we address Medicaid and sustainability, there's a recognition that you've got a level of cost shift that goes on. If you, let's just say that you move forward with the cuts that were proposed either in the discussion draft or in the House bill, you're going to have individuals that then go off Medicaid. We haven't helped facilitate a way for them to gain affordable coverage, and so what happens to them? It's not that they're not going to get sick anymore. It's not that they're not going to need that level of treatment at a substance abuse facility, or it's that the costs are going to be shifted somewhere else. And whether it's to our emergency rooms, again, where now our hospitals are going to see their costs of uncompensated care go through the roof, and then who do they shift that to? It comes back to quite honestly, those that are able to have a level of coverage, and so then your costs go up. So this is not a sustainable model. So you're absolutely right in that Medicaid must be addressed, the levels of spending, and how we work to address the lines that are not coming together but are actually getting worse. Here in the state of Alaska, we are on track right now. In 2026, we will be the state in the country that has the fastest growing population over 85 years of age. So think about what that means. And they're going to be coming to you and Homer because everyone wants to retire here. We just heard that from Reid and the other new inductee. So think about what that's going to do for our costs here in the state of Alaska, where we have most of our Medicaid dollars, or the largest percent of our Medicaid dollars, goes for that senior care, that elder care, that long-term care.
because those are our real cost drivers. More of our children are on Medicaid than the senior population, but the cost is in that older population. So think about what that means. If we can't get some level of sustainability within Medicaid, what that's going to mean to us going forward for the state. And we're just one small example here, but our statistics perhaps make the case even more dramatically for why you've got to get to a level of sustainability. Judge?
Yeah, Lisa and I were both law clerks in the Akron Superior Court, many years before Lisa. And we both liked the bar exam so much we took it more than once. But my question, I know that healthcare is important, but also we recently found out that the North Korean missiles can reach Alaska, and we're being told that out of the last 18 tests, it only worked 10 times. That has to be addressed, doesn't it?
Well, the last test, which was May 30th, was a successful test, which was good. I think we're all waking up to the reality of a North Korea that is cause for alarm. And when I say alarm, I don't mean that we all we all move under the table, but we have a young leader over there who feels like he has something to prove. He has tested missiles at a level and an intensity of a pace that we didn't see with his father. And so making sure that we as a nation are working to treat this threat with the seriousness that it demands is important. Now, we know that in Alaska, we have because of our geography, a resource. I'll call it a resource because that's what I view our ground-based missile defense outside of Greeley. That resource is being enhanced by the long-range discrimination radar that is being put into clear Air Force Base just outside of Fairbanks. It's further enhanced by the other infrastructure development or support that we are seeing in this state, and I think that is important. I think it's important to show that we have that level of coverage not for Alaska necessarily, but for the nation as a whole, and that's why our geography serves us so well, because we will be that umbrella. There's been a lot of speculation in the past few days since the 4th of July as to, so what exactly do we do? You can continue to direct sanctions. Those don't seem to have to really generated much attention. Certainly, there needs to be greater pressure on China to utilize their relationship with North Korea, and I think that takes a broader effort beyond just President Trump visiting and making sure that President Xi is with us on this. This takes a broader worldwide effort. And I think we have seen a level of escalation in this past week, in these past few days, that most were hoping we would never see. Maybe this is what precipitates that broader level of engagement from other nations to weigh in. The threat to those who are on that line between North and South Korea is one that I'm very troubled by. And so we're at a new level of intensity, I think, with North Korea. So I have not had an opportunity to be briefed on this since it was also so fresh just for 4th of July. But about 6 or 7 weeks or so ago, we did have a briefing with the executive about the concerns with North Korea. So my hope is that this next week, that will be one of our initial priorities, is understanding exactly where we are and where we go.
Senator, is there anything being done that would actually limit costs? I'm not talking about, you know, who pays or that, but who charges and what is charged and why it's charged. I see medicines all of a sudden going up thousands of percent in cost with no apparent reason for it other than profit taking. Is there something or is there something being done?
Well, I think it's fair to say that within the proposal that we had in front of us, that there is not, in my view, there's nothing specific to that. And this is one of the concerns. If you ask people what it is that they hope to get from health care reform, they would say, well, reform means that it's going to be more affordable and all have equal or better access. It's not any great rocket science. But we don't see, specific to your point about those things that bring down, say, for instance, the cost of drugs. Because when you think about the cost drivers of healthcare, drugs are that component piece that are almost unchecked. And I think this is what you see with some of the stories that are out there, whether it's the EpiPen that's been around for forever, and all of a sudden it goes from a couple $100 to a couple $1,000, or medication that has been out on the market for years and is actually more expensive now than it was when it first came out. Those are areas of concern that I think that we can target. It's not just what's going on with the cost of prescription drugs, but also the transparency of a process. Just what it costs to obtain care. At the town hall meeting that we just had, there were a couple people who stood and said, I didn't get my care here. I went to Thailand. And there was a level of affordability for a process that made it worth my while to make that trip. We ought not be in that place where people in this country feel that the only way that they can get affordable health care is to leave. We had a woman from Central Peninsula speak to their, we want to work with the community to help address some of the financial insecurity that comes, but we've got good Alaskans that want to provide for these healthcare services for us in the towns that we want to live in. I don't think most people, when they're ill or when they're recovering from surgery, really want to be away from their homes. So how we can bring about a level of transparency is important. I know that in the legislature, I think it was Representative Sponholz has a measure that focuses on transparency of costs. I had my knee reworked several years ago, and I was told, well, you pick which hospital you want to go to, because my orthopedic surgeon had privileges at several different places. And I said, well, which one's cheaper? And he said, I don't know. And I said, how can you not know? You're the surgeon. He says, I can tell you what I am going to charge you, but I can't tell you about the rest of it. I think most of us would say, hey, everything else that I purchase, I know kind of the range that I'm going to be charged, if not exactly to the penny. And so these are the types of areas of oversight that I think we haven't addressed and what we have in front of us right now.
There's a question over there.
Yeah, hi. I hear you talk about your care for the environment and working bipartisan, but I have to say that I notice that a lot of your votes are along party line. And one of my deepest concerns is the appointment of Scott Pruitt and the diminishment of the EPA, which has really opened up Pebble Mine now. They're planning on coming back in. Hillcore's just bought up all those leases. They're buying lands all the way to Anchor Point.
Right.
Where is your concern on this, and what are you willing to do?
Well, I supported Scott Pruitt, and I'll tell you why I supported. I will tell you why I supported him. This is a guy who, as Attorney General from Oklahoma, has some very strong and legitimate credentials in terms of how he has, as Attorney General, managed in the state of Oklahoma. When I sat down with him before his confirmation, to say, where is your priority as head of EPA? What is your focus going to be? Because my focus with the EPA is you've got a pretty direct mission. It's clean air, it's clean water. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. EPA, clean air, clean water, under the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. So what are you going to do to focus on just that? And his response to me was, this is what we should be doing. This is what we should be doing and focusing on. So whether it is making sure that we are cleaning up our Superfund sites, which, well, we might not have the level of Superfund sites that they have in the lower 48. What we have are legacy wells that have been unattended up north. What we have are our contaminated lands that have been transferred to our native people as part of their land claim settlement, and they were transferred contaminated lands. And everyone's kind of pointing the finger and saying, well, it's that agency's responsibility to clean up or that agency's responsibility to clean up. No one is taking that lead. So what are you doing to help address how we get our lands cleaned up, how we ensure that our lands don't continue to be polluted, and what we're doing with our clean water. So I'm the chairman of the Interior Appropriations Subcommittee. So as I'm looking at his budget, or the budget that's coming out of the White House there, I want to make sure, are we funding the targeted airshed grants so that communities like Fairbanks, who are dealing with particulate matter that is harmful, that those kinds of grants continue. Again, we mentioned NOAA, not necessarily within the EPA budget, but making sure that we are focusing on the research and the data that allows us to better understand what's going on with ocean acidification. What is this? What is the impact going to be to us? So science has got to be part of the priority when you think about your federal dollars and how they work. So I know that there's some heartburn from folks who say, well, I'm worried that he is just going to eradicate the EPA. The in fairness, the EPA needs to have the resources within its budget to do the job that they need. That's part of my job, and my responsibility to that is going to be to make sure that the men and women who need to implement so much of what we're talking about when it comes to clean air, clean water, continues. So keep me to task on that.
So one more short question.
All the way in the back. Yeah.
I'd just like to say that I hope that you're able to keep your commitment to not defund Planned Parenthood. That's really important to me. And I also
also take note of your pointing out what is so unsustainable about the current program for healthcare, and will be even more so in a negative direction with the Republican proposal. I think that the high costs of healthcare are something that have been addressed by other nations with pretty good outcomes relative to the United States in terms of people's health. And although there's only 30% of the population now that favors a single payer system, I would encourage you to be open-minded about exploring those possibilities as that percentage increases, because that unsustainability that you're talking about is definitely operating.
Let me comment on the Planned Parenthood piece, because that is something that comes up just about everywhere I go, and there are some who sport the pink shirts, and thank you for your advocacy. Access in Alaska, as we know, is challenging. And so when you take away access, you need to look really critically at why you're taking that away. And when you say to one entity alone, that the Medicaid dollars that follow a woman can't follow her to Planned Parenthood, they can follow her to other facilities, but they can't follow her. So you're basically taking away her choice to go to the provider that she wants, which is wrong. And you're taking away access in an area where we're already limited with our access. I want to make sure that the women and the men who utilize the services at Planned Parenthood are able to go to a place where there is a level of affordability, where there is a level of care that can be given pretty much that day, that week. So making sure that we're only going forward in terms of improving access has got to be a priority, and particularly for women and women's health care needs. So making sure that the support continues for Planned Parenthood is important. I have said from the get-go that this whole issue of defund, or it's not actually defunding, but not allowing for the Medicaid reimbursement, this has no business in a healthcare reform bill. And I remain convinced.